in a downtown bistro. Portrait? Jamie drew you for us. I still have it. I'll bring it to show you tomorrow. He did it from memory, which seemed extraordinary to me, and even more so now that I see how apt it was. She puts her hand on Marion's. I'm so pleased to meet you, even though I'm sorry the circumstances aren't happier. I don't know how Jamie knew to contact me. I've helped other girls in situations like yours, but I certainly never mentioned anything about that to him. He must have good intuition. He does, usually, and he adored you and your daughters. Mrs. Fahey, perhaps hearing the exclusion of her husband, smiles and releases Marion's hand. He and Sarah, in particular, had a special friendship. She stirs sugar into her coffee. I'd like for you to meet her, but now might not be the time. How is Jamie? He didn't say anything about himself in his letter. I've been imagining him at the University of Montana, but the postmark was from Vancouver. He's well. Marion hesitates, wondering if this elegant woman, lifting her coffee cup so delicately by its handle, won't find Jamie's life strange or disappointing. He's trying to be an artist. Mrs. Fahey brightens. Oh, I'm glad. His talent seemed unusual. I hope he's famous one day. No, I shouldn't frame it that way. I hope he's fulfilled. Me too. The woman looks at her, head cocked. The way Jamie described you, I was expecting someone more unorthodox. I mean, in the way you dress. I'm trying not to stand out. Why? My husband will have people looking for me. Ah, Mrs. Fahey says. I see. The next morning, when Mrs. Fahey comes to Marion's hotel to escort her to the doctor, she unrolls a sheet of paper, holds it up so Marion can study her own charcoal image. Jamie would draw me differently now, she says. It doesn't seem possible I was ever so sure of myself. I don't pretend to know you well, but I think you are very brave. Mrs. Fahey re-rolls the drawing, holds it out. You take this as a reminder. Marion shakes her head. I don't know if I can keep it safe, but someday I'd like to have it. Do you mind holding on to it a while longer? A tray of instruments rattling on wheels, a bright ceiling light, the sweetness of ether, an afternoon spent in bed in the hotel, some blood, a dull pain. In the evening, she writes a long letter, pages and pages, folds them carefully into an envelope. From the hotel's telephone book, she copies the address for the Bureau of Internal Revenue, buys a stamp from the man at the front desk. The next day, she wanders along the waterfront, all the way down to a Hooverville that had once been a shipyard, looks out over the broken, ramshackle geometry of the shacks, dirt packed like grout in between. The pain of ice in her is gone, as is the bit of life floating beneath it. But she has not been restored to how she was before. Only feels a new loss, welcome but still felt. On her way back to the hotel, she posts her letter. The next day, she books passage to Alaska. Jane Smith, she tells the man in the ticket window, and so he records her on the manifest. In 1934, planes can fly farther, faster, in worse weather. More routes are opening. Jean Batten, a New Zealander, flies from England to Australia, beating Amy Johnson's record by 4 days. Today there is a statue of her at the Auckland airport. Sir Charles Kingsford Smith crosses the Pacific from west to east. The Sydney airport is named for him. The Alaska Territory is big country, rough country, country without roads, country best traveled by air. Fly an hour or walk a week, they say. Mail routes that take a dog sled nearly a month might take a plane 7 hours. Alaskans are already the flyingest people, but they need more pilots. In the end, it is simple for Marianne to do the thing she's always longed to do, get paid to fly. Fresh off the ship in Anchorage, she'd found a place to live, bought a truck, and gone from hangar to hangar, Jane Smith in search of work, showing her logbook as proof of her experience. Asked about a license, she'd said, "I never got one." Then no one pressed her about why not. Alaskans aren't big on bureaucracy. The logbook is an irregular document. So many destinations recorded no more precisely than Canada. So many flights marked simply cargo. Even her name, so scrupulously plain, has an air of erasure. A man with a hangdog face, scarred lip, and crumpled hat looked at the logbook, looked at her, took her up for a check ride, hired her on the spot. She flies people and supplies where they need to go. Learns to fly float planes, lands on water, lands on skis in the winter. She does most of her own maintenance. Has to do emergency repairs so often, she doesn't consider much an emergency anymore. The small house she rents is on the outer fringe of town, where it's easy to keep to herself. Was this what her father had done after he left Missoula? Slung his skills over his shoulder and set out? Sometimes she startles awake at the sound of animals outside, thinks Barclay has come for her. She keeps a rifle by the bed. "What are you doing messing around with planes? You're good-looking enough to get a husband," a pilot says from behind her, low and turgid, standing too close as she fills a canister with water for a plane's radiator. "Especially here." "I had one once," she says. "He's dead," her voice like a chipped blade. He steps back, waits for her to crank closed the tap. On clear days, north across the Cook Inlet, Mount McKinley appears. If she flies in that direction, it grows and grows, white as the moon, seeming to rise as the moon does, seeming separate from the earth, too huge to be of it. To the east are the sawtoothed Chugach Mountains, the Wrangell Mountains beyond, the Alaska Range to the north. Mountains everywhere. Monstrous ice-choked cousins of the forested peaks that had encircled her as she looped and spun over Missoula. She doesn't dare do aerobatics in Alaska. Doesn't want word to get around of a girl with a knack for them. The impulse to flee persists. The horizon beckons. If she could just go farther, live nowhere, possess only an airplane, and if that airplane never needed to land, then maybe she would feel free. Jamie moves out of the flop house, finds a small apartment of his own on a quieter street in the same neighborhood. One room only, but clean and tidy with pine floors, and an oddly miniature bathtub he can only fit in with his knees bent nearly to his chest. "Did you answer an ad seeking a gnome?" says one of his boar bristle friends. Judith has gone to Europe to, as she put it, see what it's all about. "You won't pine for me, will you?" she'd asked him. "Because I'm going to forget all about you." And she'd smiled her crafty smile that could have meant either she was joking or she wasn't. There is often a loose swirl of women around them, Jamie and his friends, and Jamie now takes his appeal for granted. To demonstrate that he is, in fact, not pining for Judith, he beds the cigarette girl from a billiard hall, a couple of barmaids, a girl he meets out dancing who never stops making tart little jokes out of the corner of her mouth, even when she's naked. He regards his old belief that he should love the women he sleeps with as touchingly naive. Judith has left some of her books in his keeping, and he reads modern French painters, painters of the modern mind, the artist and psychoanalysis. He worries he has strayed too far from the picturesque, that his lines lack rhythm, his compositions originality, that he is old-fashioned. He worries he has nothing to say with his paintings, and that is why Judith has gone to Europe, to find men who do. "Thanks, love," he says to the women he buys beer and cigarettes from, not even hearing the word anymore. 11 days into 1935, Amelia Earhart becomes the first person to fly solo from Honolulu to Oakland. Stars hang outside the cockpit window near enough to touch, she writes. 10,000 people surround her after she lands, and her red Lockheed Vega seems to wallow on a human sea. I wouldn't want to fly over that much ocean, says Marion's boss, the man with the scarred lip. He's not one for posturing, and she likes him for it. Most of the other guys say they'd do it, too, if they had the kind of money Earhart has from her husband, and from smiling for pictures and putting her name on malted milk tablets and luggage sets and whatever else. They act like her flights somehow don't count, aren't real. Jane Smith is a real Alaska flyer now. She shuttles between towns and what pass for cities, out to bush villages and encampments and lonely cabins, bringing mail, food, fuel, dogs, dog sleds, newspapers, motorcycles, explosives, wallpaper, tobacco, doorknobs, you name it. She flies men out into the backcountry who strike it rich, and others who drown or freeze or get eaten by bears or blow themselves up. She flies corpses wrapped in canvas sacks. Once, a corpse smells so bad she lashes it to the wing. Once, a woman gives birth in her plane. Once, she lands on the frozen surface of the Chukchi Sea to rescue the passengers of a ship locked in ice. Somewhere, she picks up a Russian word, polynya, for the patches of open water in the sea ice where whales come to breathe. The landscape is secretive and harsh and impossibly immense, and she borrows some of its inscrutability for herself, its disinterest in human goings-on. Unfriendliness is another form of camouflage. In winter, the sun rises in the south. Far enough north, it never rises at all. She wears long johns and wool sweaters, and over those, a reindeer hide suit. At first glance, you wouldn't even peg the pilot, Jane Smith, as a woman, would only see a shaggy block. She still remembers sitting in the water grizzly, signs a blank postcard to Caleb that way and asks someone going to Oregon to mail it from there. But she carries a knife and a pistol for when second and third glances happen. Rough country. Cold is murder on planes. Fuel tanks freeze, hydraulic pumps don't work, rubber tires and gaskets turn brittle and leaky, instruments quit. On cold mornings, she lights a fire pod under the engine, puts a canvas tarp over it to keep the heat in, watches like a hawk because the gas or oil or tarp itself might ignite at any moment and sometimes does. She puts out more fires than she can remember. She's broken propellers, skis, a wing, flown with sprays of leaking gasoline fanning out behind her. Once, what she thought was solid ground had turned out to be marsh and splashed up at her as the wheels touched, flipping the plane. She was all right, hanging upside down in her seat, mucky water running in under her head. A mule team had to come pull the plane out. She patches skis with flattened out gas cans, propellers with stovepipes, struts with birch trees. She flies in weather others shake their heads at, stashes her money away as she's done since she was a child. Once, she flies to McCarthy, only knows she's to pick up a man and bring him back to Anchorage. He's waiting beside the airstrip in handcuffs. He's a miner, she's told. He raped another miner's wife. Fine, she says. She has them stow him in the back with some bundled furs she's picked up. They cuff him to his seat. 15 minutes in the air, and she rolls the old junker plane tidily upside down. She figures if it breaks apart, at least she'll take him with her. But they come upright again. He's screaming, both his shoulders dislocated. Bad weather, she says when she delivers him under a bright blue sky. Got bumped around a bit. The story gets out. Makes a man think twice before he tries to get close to her. Come summertime, the one-eyed circumnavigator Wiley Post is touring Alaska with beloved national wit Will Rogers in a nose-heavy, cobbled-together plane. Wings from one model, fuselage from another, pontoons from yet another. Marion glimpses them in August when she's up in Fairbanks. Shakes her head at that plane, those fat pontoons. Near Barrow, at the northern edge of the continent, Post and Rogers crash, taking off from a lagoon, and die. Marion knows lots of dead pilots now. Alaska's an easy place to crack up. Bush pilots fly into mountains, vanish over the ocean. All the more reason to keep to herself. No need to mourn. Helen Ritchie, a well-known racer and aerobatics pilot, gets hired by Central Airlines to be the first American woman to fly commercial passenger aircraft. But she's rarely on the roster, isn't trusted in bad weather, is asked to give talks promoting the airline instead of actually flying. The men in the pilots' union, there are only men in the pilots' union, won't let her join. She quits. What else can she do? No American airline hires another female pilot for another 38 years. A new American plane, the DC-3, makes commercial passenger travel profitable. Can take off from mud, sand, snow, whatever you want. Develops a reputation for being tough, even indestructible. Two propellers, a 95-foot wingspan, an engine that can be serviced quickly and easily. The wartime version will be the C-47. 10,000 of them. Skytrains, Dakotas, Goonie Birds. They'll fly the hump from India to China, schlepping cargo through a maze of mountains too high to fly over, the passes still at 15,000 feet. They'll disperse D-Day paratroopers like dandelion seeds. They'll crash in jungles and deserts and mountains and cities. They'll litter the ocean floors. Of the ones that survive the war, plenty will be repainted, refitted, find new peacetime careers. One will be the Peregrine. In November, a balloon called Explorer 2 is released in South Dakota, reaches 72,395 feet with two men inside. An altitude record that will stand for almost 20 years. In their photos, seen for the first time, the curvature of the earth. Jamie happens upon the images in a magazine, goes home and slathers white gesso over a canvas, erasing a half-finished harbor scene. He begins again, a segment of his neighborhood from a high angle, almost a bird's view, slightly warped as though by the shape of the planet, with shallow bands of harbor, mountains, and sky squeezed in at the top, ever so slightly bowed. What he wants to express, he has come to realize, is infinite space. A Mr. Ayukawa, who owns a department store in Japantown, buys the painting from Flavian's gallery. When Jamie stops in to collect the check, Flavian relays an offer of a commission. Mr. Ayukawa would like a portrait of his daughter. He's a businessman, Flavian says, his voice heavy with significance. You know my meaning. He is in many businesses. Jamie is reminded unpleasantly of how people had talked about Barclay McQueen. You are a polite person, but you should be extra polite to him. Oh, you know that Judith is back? I've seen her. Judith had swanned into a boar bristle lecture, her new French husband in tow, a poet, apparently. She'd kissed Jamie on both cheeks, told him he must go to Europe, that Vancouver was utterly provincial, that art here was barely even art. He'd wanted to ask her why she'd come back then, though he suspected the answer was because in Europe she would not have had the pleasure of lording her time in Europe over everyone else. He remembered Sarah Fahey's sister calling Seattle a backwater, how she'd made him embarrassed for believing Seattle marvelous and cosmopolitan. He went out and got drunk after that, painfully nostalgic for the months he'd spent enchanted by Judith, the thrill of climbing the dark stairs to her studio, the way her skin was always filmed with fine gray dust from her clay. He'd really thought, fool, that when she came back, she would feel more for him than before, that somehow the expansion of her world would not diminish his place in it. The Ayukawa family lives in a fine white house on Oppenheimer Park. Miss Ayukawa, 18 years old, a Nisei born in Canada, sits for him in a large parlor furnished in a ponderous Western style with dark rugs and heavy furniture. His painting of the neighborhood has been mounted above a long walnut sideboard. The room might have been gloomy but for the large windows. It is a breezy, unusually sunny morning. As Jamie makes preliminary sketches, rafts of yellow light and leafy shadow sweep across the floor. "We'll never have this light again," he says. "I shouldn't get used to it." She wears a plain brown day dress. Her hair is swept up in a smooth twist. Sally, she's said to call her. Her beauty doesn't escape him, even in his downtrodden state. "I should remember this city as gray because it almost always is," she says. "But I think I'll remember the sunny days best." "Remember it?" He glances at her grandmother, present as a chaperone, clad in a cotton kimono and asleep on a burgundy silk sofa. Her needlework lies abandoned in her lap. Her wire-rimmed spectacles have slipped toward the tip of her nose.
"I'm going to Japan. I'm getting married."
"Oh, I see." Her tone does not invite congratulations. "And this portrait is a wedding gift?" Her upper lip flattens in anger. Her feathery eyebrows draw together.
"It's for my parents to remember me by."
He doesn't know what to ask that will unearth what he wants to know. Instead, he asks her to tip her head down just a bit. After 2 hours, a uniformed maid comes and ushers him out. The next time he comes to the house, the day is overcast. But the scene is as it was before. Sally in the brown dress, beside the same window, her grandmother asleep on the sofa. Sally gazes out the window, still and steady, but as Jamie works, he senses inward agitation. He has not looked at a person so carefully in a long time, is out of practice trying to depict, the way he had in Seattle, the tidal zone where a person's inner and outer selves wash together.
"How do you want your parents to remember you?"
he says, moving his brush rapidly over the canvas.
"As I am, I suppose."
"What I mean is, a person's thoughts show through. For example, if you want to leave behind a version of yourself that's happy, you should think about happy things."
"Happy things," she repeats, looking again out the window. "I'm going to a country I've never been, where I know no one, to marry a man I've seen one photograph of. I'm afraid an abundance of happy things doesn't spring to mind."
Her voice has risen, and she and Jamie both look at her grandmother, who does not stir.
"Only one photograph?" Jamie says. "Is that common?"
"It used to be, coming the other way. My mother was a picture bride. My father was already here. Their families arranged the match. She didn't mind. Her generation didn't expect anything better. But I'm from here. My father has odd ideas. He doesn't want to go back himself, but he says it's important we don't lose touch with our homeland. His homeland."
With a small sigh, her grandmother rouses herself. She pushes her spectacles into place. "Junko," she says, and asks a question in Japanese that Sally answers, her tone light.
"She wants to know if you're making me beautiful," she tells Jamie.
"What did you say?"
"I said I'd told you to paint me as I am."
"They're the same," he says, made reckless by his persistent, mortifying melancholy over Judith.
He doesn't know if he is trying to drive away his sadness or make it worse by groveling before another unattainable woman. Sally does not translate.
She settles back into her pose, but now she looks directly at him rather than out the window.
What does Junko mean?
He asks after a while.
It's my Japanese name, she says.
After a pause, she adds, I don't like it. I'd rather just have one name. He returns three more times. She continues to watch him while he paints. He sees, or thinks he sees, different moods sweep through her gaze the same way the leaf shadows blow across the floor. Defiance is what he chooses to paint. Defiance, but as a mercy to her parents, none of the anger that comes and goes. He sees curiosity, too, when she looks at him. Judith only ever looked amused or bored. Impossible, perhaps, to spend so many hours looking into a person's eyes and not imagine an unspoken intimacy.
I love these because I love thinking about you looking at me,
Sarah Fahey had said about his drawings of her.
Does Sally like thinking about him looking at her?
When he works on the portrait at home between sittings, he feels a tension, a winching together that tightens into urgent desire. He adds a faint warp to the portrait's background, a suggestion of curvature, of the room pulling away from behind Sally, pushing her closer to the viewer. On the last day she sits for him, he slips her a scrap of paper with his address written on it, whispers that he'd like to see her again. She looks at the paper, slides it into her pocket. When she raises her gaze to him again, he sees contempt, and he has a terrible sense of having made a major miscalculation. None of what he'd sensed roiling in her head had anything to do with him. He is just some unimportant man trying to insinuate himself into her hour of crisis. He paints falteringly for another half hour, gives it up. He will finish it in his apartment. I've got enough from life, he tells her. Three nights later, in the small hours, there is a knock at his door. Quiet but urgent, a light, persistent rapping. He gets out of bed and pads across, wide awake, thinking she's come after all. He is filled with a vision of how she will look, how she will rush into his arms, how they will escape together. Two men are outside the door, white men. Neither as tall as Jamie, but both built like steamer trunks. They push in before he can recover from his surprise, bundling him across the room by the arms, pushing him to the floor. Through his terror, he wonders why he had ever thought Barclay would come personally. He'd always imagined being able to at least try to reason with the man, to appeal to his feelings for Marion, to explain that he needed to let her go. One steamer trunk sits on him while the other closes the door, calmly turns on the bath tap.
We just want to know where she is, the one sitting on him says. That's all. We'll leave you be once you tell us.
I don't know, he says. She didn't tell me. She knew better than that. She knew he'd send you. She was going to Seattle and then on from there to somewhere else. That's all I know.
You expect us to believe you didn't come up with a little plan together? Says the man by the tub.
We'll see,
the other man says matter-of-factly. He has a job to do, that's all. There will be no appealing, no explaining. Jamie understands this as he is hoisted up beside the bathtub, struck in the face before his head and shoulders are plunged into the cold water.
I don't know anything else, he says when he's lifted out.
Again, he's held under, brought out, struck.
Please,
he says, until he can't summon the breath to speak. In the morning, he finds himself still alive, lying curled on the bare pine floor. He hauls himself up, runs a hot bath. The touch of the porcelain is horrible to him, the water full of menace, but the warmth eases his pain. Lying cramped in the tub, in water tinted pink from his blood, he plans what he will do. Everything he will take with him fits in one suitcase. Some clothes, his better paints and brushes, sketchbooks. Because he will go from the Ayukawa house to the train station, he carries the suitcase in one hand by its handle and Sally's portrait clutched carefully by a stretcher bar in the other. The paint is not quite dry. The maid's eyes widen when she opens the door, takes in his swollen face.
No, she whispers, go away.
She makes a shooing gesture. He says, please tell Sally, Junko, or her grandmother, or whoever is home that I'm here, and I've brought the painting, and I need to be paid.
No, the maid says again, go away.
Jamie's confusion is intensified by his general state of addledness, his pounding headache, his urgent, determined need to flee the city. Why would the maid send him away when he's brought the painting? He needs the money he's owed, no matter how rude he must be to get it. More loudly, he tries to explain again, asks for Sally. He is nearly shouting when a dapper man in a gray suit appears beside the maid. She retreats into the house with a bow. Jamie has not met Mr. Ayukawa before. His thick, bushy eyebrows are so unlike Sally's feathery ones. But Jamie recognizes her expression when he draws them together. I am surprised you would come here, he says. I'm leaving town, Jamie says, uneasy, and I wanted to be paid for this. He turns the canvas to face Mr. Ayukawa, and the man's eyebrows fly up. His face is full of the same mournful astonishment as the face in the moon. When he speaks, it's in a whisper. Just tell me where she is. Jamie stares. What? The man stares back. We found your address in her room. You must know. Where is she? And finally, Jamie understands.
Memories Roadshow. 14. A few days after the table read, even though I'd been determined to make Redwood get in touch first, I'd cracked and texted him. Just following up to make a plan for a totally normal, earthbound hangout. I'd love that. Let me check my schedule and circle back. But I hadn't heard anything for another week. Until he wrote, hey, stranger, my mother is in town and I'd love for you guys to meet. Come over for dinner? When I arrived, Carol Pfeiffer was the one to answer the door. She keeled back for a hug, arms out, fingers extended into stiff prongs. Here she is, she cried, her voice redolent with Long Island. At first, I thought she was talking about herself. Here I am. Her face was sharp as a hewn arrowhead. Her hair was the ideal version of a practical bob. Under austere layers of charcoal linen, she carried herself with regal assurance, like a spiritual guru or a university president. I've been dying to meet you, Carol said, leading me toward the kitchen by the arm. She leaned back, looked me up and down. I'm not disappointed. You're every inch the star. I gave a snorty little dismissive chuckle. I liked your book. She turned to me, glowing. Thank you, my dear. Thank you so much. I never expected this to come of it. I just wanted to tell a story. Leave it to my son to make a, she waved her hands, whole big thing. But you know, Marion is so important to me. I had a terrible marriage, quite honestly, and in the depths of it, I found such comfort in Marion's book. She got me through the darkest part of my life. She inspired me to seize my freedom, which is ironic because I never would have known about her if not for the connection to my ex-husband's family. She reached to squeeze my arm. And now, you are going to bring her to so many people. You'll change lives, Hadley. She nodded at me earnestly, rapidly forestalling any skepticism. You will. I didn't tell her the only life I'd given much thought to was changing my own. I didn't tell her about my covetous vision of myself hoisting a golden prize. I hope so, I said. Redwood was in the kitchen, tending something in a pan. I hadn't known anyone else would be there, but a girl in a white sleeveless jumpsuit and no jewelry except for a small gold ring in her nostril was leaning against the counter with a glass of rosé. She had curly hair up in a bun, a tiny, beautiful, dark-eyed face. Something about her reminded me of marzipan, the little animals you're not quite sure are food or figurines. "Look what the cat dragged in," Carol said, presenting me. And the girl put her hand on Redwood's upper arm, like mine. And in a flash, I decided that this, she, was why we hadn't hooked up. Why he'd been AWOL. That dick had told me there wasn't anyone. No one at all. "Hey, stranger," Redwood said. And it rankled just like it had in his text, as though he were subtly chiding me for being out of touch, when he was the one who'd left me hanging. He kissed my cheek and gestured to the white jumpsuit. "This is Leanne." Leanne waved from where she was, determinedly unfazed by my celebrity, and Redwood pointed out the window. "The Day brothers are here too, and Mom brought a friend." I turned. So it was a whole convention. Redwood wanting me to meet his mother didn't make me special. Outside, a wiry older woman with close-cropped silver hair was standing beside the pool, drinking a glass of red wine and, without visible reaction, listening to whatever one of the Day brothers was saying. She wore jeans and slip-on Vans and a big white button-up shirt. The Days were wearing dress shirts and chinos so tightly tailored they looked like superheroes' unitards. "That's Adelaide Scott," Carol said in such a way I knew I was supposed to recognize the name. "Ah," I said. Leanne, seeing right through me, said, "She's a famous artist." "A sculptor," Carol said, "and installations. She actually met Marion Graves once, when she was a child. I brought her because I thought you might be interested in picking her brain. Not that she's not excellent company in her own right." What was I supposed to take from a child's memory at least 65 years old? What tidbit could this woman give me that I could possibly use? There should be an antiques roadshow for memories, and I would sit behind a desk and explain that while your memory might be lovely and have tremendous sentimental value, it was worth nothing to anyone but you. People's thoughts about Marion were all basically the same, but usually presented with an air of revelation. Bart Olufsen had stared earnestly into my face and said things like, "I see her as being very strong, very brave," as though this was some radical theory. "Absolutely," I'd said. "Someone who's so strong, so brave like that. She was compelled to do the flight. Otherwise, she would have exploded." "Totally," I said, even though bravery and strength aren't reasons, but qualities. I don't think she had a reason. Not really. Why does anyone want to do anything? You just do. "Adelaide," Carol called, "come meet Hadley." The woman and the Days all turned. The Day who'd been talking extended one arm to usher Adelaide in, and I caught a trace of disdainful amusement on her face at being herded. "Hello, Hadley," she said, shaking my hand after they'd all trooped inside and the Days had cheek-kissed me. She was tall and willowy, had a long, pale, lined face, and wore no wedding band. No makeup except for dark red lipstick. I couldn't decide if she was beautiful. "I hear you're an actress." Carol made a show of friendly exasperation. "Hadley's a movie star, Adelaide." Adelaide's tone conveyed a shrug. I'm afraid pop culture is an area I've particularly neglected. But pop culture is so fascinating, said one of the days. You just have to look at it on a deeper level. It's like contemporary art in that sometimes the actual product isn't the point as much as the context in which it's created. Adelaide gazed at him without interest. I agree, Leanne jumped in. Like, take Hadley's Archangel movies. As a feminist, I object to their emphasis on traditional gender roles. The man as the protector, you know. But as a consumer, I was still sucked into the love story, gobbling down the popcorn. It's a dog whistle only women can hear. She took a green olive from a bowl and popped it into her mouth. I asked her, how do you and Redwood know each other? We're old friends, Redwood said. We deflowered each other, Leanne said, extracting the olive pit from her lips. Leanne, Carol said, covering her ears. Don't pretend you didn't know, said Leanne. A buzz. Redwood went to the panel on the wall. Hello? It's Hugo, came a roar through it. It was right before she left on the flight, Adelaide said. She came to see my mother in Seattle. I would have been 5. The 8 of us were sitting at the table outside, under the wisteria, eating salmon with some kind of too-sweet sauce of Redwood's invention. Redwood had set out place cards, which meant I now knew which day was Kyle and which was Travis. My family collected art, Adelaide went on. My mother was an old friend of Jamie Graves. We still own quite a few of his paintings, though most are out on loan. Carol piped up. That's how I found Adelaide. I knew of her work, of course, but I didn't realize there was any connection to the Graves story until I was researching my book and started looking into her family's collection. I've been thinking, wouldn't it be fabulous if there were a Jamie Graves exhibit to coincide with the release of the film? At LACMA, Travis Day said. 100% yes. Or maybe a more unconventional space somewhere. Yes, Carol interrupted. LACMA would be fabulous. Or somewhere more unconventional, Travis said again. Like a warehouse or somewhere repurposed. Do you want me to talk about Marion Graves or no? Adelaide said. Travis looked miffed. Carol clapped a hand over her mouth. Go ahead, she said in a muffled voice. Marion came to town in 1949 just to see my mother, Adelaide said. They'd never met before, but they had Jamie in common. And also, Carol put this in the book, my grandmother had helped Marion get an abortion when she was leaving her husband, although no one told me that until I was an adult. That's why she came, Hugo said, to reminisce. You'd have to ask her, Adelaide said. Good luck with that. I took a preparatory breath. I had a sense of fulfilling my duty, asking my prearranged question like the littlest kid on Passover. What was Marion like? I said. Scraping the sauce off her fish with a butter knife, Adelaide said. I couldn't say, really. I told Carol I wouldn't be much help to you, as I wasn't much help to her. You were a tremendous help, said Carol. Sir Hugo leaned forward and fixed Adelaide with his signature piercing stare. But you do remember her. Adelaide seemed immune to the piercing, refused to buy into the drama of her role as eyewitness. She made an inscrutable moo with her red lips, said, Marion Graves was a very tall, very thin, very blonde grown-up I was called in to greet more than 60 years ago. I don't think she was good with children. I don't think she said much to me. Honestly, I'm not positive I actually remember her at all, or if I just remember the memory. She looked at me. See, nothing you can use. You never know, said Carol. It was you who told me about Caleb Bitterroot. She turned to Hadley. There's very little out there about him, but once I realized he'd been in Marion's life from beginning to end, I saw the outline of a grand romance. I'm very intuitive that way. What she means is that there's no proof of any romance at all, Redwood said, and Carol made a psh sound and flicked her hand at him. Is it different? Leanne asked Sir Hugo. Playing a real person versus a fictional character? He swirled his wine. A bit. With a real person, you need to be cautious of falling back on an impression. Your task is to make the person, fictional or not, seem real. Same with writing, said Kyle Day, but no one paid him any attention. It's not like you can really know that much about anyone, anyway, I said, annoyed that Leanne had clearly intended the acting question only for Hugo. No one sees most of what we do. No one knows more than a tiny fraction of what we think. And when we die, it all evaporates. Adelaide looked at me with a new glint of interest, sharp but unreadable. My parents died in a small plane crash when I was 2, I told her. I was raised by my uncle. Ah, she said. So you understand something about Marion? I don't know, I said. I can't tell if I do. Mitchell Baxter, said Travis. And when Adelaide, predictably, looked blank, he added, he was Hadley's uncle. He directed Tourniquet. Ah, said Adelaide. He's dead now, too, I said. Carol, trying to get us back on track, said, I think Jamie Graves and Adelaide's mother, Sarah, will love us. Of course Carol has the spicy theory, said Leanne. Sir Hugo hoisted his distinguished eyebrows at Adelaide. Do you think they were? Or do you perhaps know? They were childhood sweethearts, she said. But in my admittedly new acquaintance with Carol, I've noticed she thinks any two people who have anything to do with each other are probably lovers. I'm a hopeless romantic, what can I say? Carol said. I'm not, said Leanne, pouring herself more wine. Me neither, said Sir Hugo. I'm a hopeful hedonist. Redwood, did you inherit the dreaded romance gene? It's recessive, said Carol. And his father did not have it. I'm open to possibilities, Redwood said. I don't know if that's romantic or not. Maybe I'm a cautious romantic. When I first met Redwood, I said, avoiding Leanne's eye, he told me his go-to emotion was ambivalence, and ambivalence isn't romantic. What about you? Adelaide looked at me glintily again. Not a romantic, I said. Come on, don't say that, said Travis, who I'd begun to sense was nursing an interest in me. Ordinarily, I might have flirted back, but something about his shininess, his zeal, repulsed me. No, Adelaide said to me. What then? Are you a cynic? A skeptic? A stoic? I don't know what I am, I said. Everything always seems to fall apart around me. You're a wrecking ball, said Sir Hugo. What about you? I asked Adelaide. I was a romantic for a long time, disastrously. I believe since then I've been what's known as an opportunist. Beadily, she looked me over. Her deadly confidence reminded me of a bird of prey, a hawk or falcon. "A piece of advice for you," she said. "Knowing what you don't want is just as useful as knowing what you do. Maybe more." Sometime after dessert, when everyone had adjourned to the living room for one more drink and to listen to Redwood play the piano, I'd gone to the bathroom. When I came out, a figure was waiting in the dark hall. Adelaide. She moved closer, holding out her phone. "I don't mean to lurk, but would you give me your number? I might have something more for you about Marion, but I didn't want the whole gang to know." Her voice was low, unhurried. I didn't ask why. I tapped my number into her phone. Then we walked back toward the crazy cascading sound of Flight of the Bumblebee, saying nothing. Locked in a conspiracy, I didn't understand.
An Incomplete History of the Graves Family. 1936 to 1939. A German immigrant named Bruno Hauptmann is convicted of kidnapping the Lindbergh baby and executed. Charles and Anne Lindbergh, hounded beyond endurance by the press, flee to England with their second son. Someone in the American embassy cooks up the bright idea that Lindbergh should pay a friendly visit to the German Air Ministry, casually gather intelligence on the new Luftwaffe. He tours fields and factories in the Air Research Institute, Aldershof. He lunches at Hermann Göring's gilded and bejeweled house, attends the opening ceremonies of the Berlin Olympics. Hitler, Lindbergh concludes, might be a bit of a fanatic, but sometimes you need a fanatic to get things done. Lindbergh is a fan of getting things done. The German people seem to be bubbling over with vigor. The Luftwaffe would woefully outmatch anything America could cobble together. No, the way German Jews have been stripped of their citizenship isn't ideal, but Nazism is certainly preferable to communism, isn't it? Two sides to every coin. In 1936, Marion is no longer Jane Smith, because Barclay is in prison. She reads about it in the newspaper. He could still send someone to find her, she supposes, but she has had enough of hiding, of vanishment. "My name is actually Marion Graves," she tells people in Alaska who have known her for more than 2 years, and they have less trouble making the switch than they might have because she seems like a different person now. "Will look you in the eye, appears capable of interest, of pleasure, unlike the gloomy and taciturn Jane Smith." With the money she's socked away, she buys her own plane, a high-wing Blanca, and goes into business for herself. For a while, she flies out of Nome, lives in a ramshackle cabin near the airfield. Musk oxen wander past her outhouse, ancient-seeming creatures, haloed by their own frozen breath, their thick coats swinging around their ankles like monks' robes. The price of gold has gone up, and she flies geologists to the fields, brings engineers to build the dredges and men to work them. With the seasons, she flies cannery workers and miners in and out. She flies to the reindeer herders, passing low over the swirling brown galaxies of their animals. People pay her in gold dust, in pelts, in firewood, in oil, in whiskey. Plenty often, they try not to pay her at all. Plenty often, she goes north over the Brooks Range, up where trees don't bother trying to grow. In Barrow, at the territory's northernmost tip, seal and polar bear skins dry on stretchers outside the houses, and staked dogs howl at her plane. Once, out of curiosity, she flies beyond the Whale Rib Gateway that marks the extent of the coast and out over the loose northern jigsaw of spring ice that the planet wears like a skullcap, flies far enough north to see where the jigsaw begins to fuse into one immense ice quilt, ridged high where the currents have forced the pieces together. A dizzy feeling to being so far north. Barclay hadn't assembled an army of lawyers when the feds came for him, but pled guilty to their charge of tax evasion. Took a sentence of 7 years. He paid a fine to the government, but the ranch is safe, as it had long been in Kate's name. Other assets, his speakeasies and roadhouses, turned legitimate businesses after the repeal of Prohibition. His hotels, his shares in mining and construction companies, the Kalispell Cottage, the Missoula House, the Stearman biplane, which had eventually been found where Marion had abandoned it. All this technically belongs to Sadler. Even Barclay's bank accounts are in the names of companies registered to Sadler. Marion flies under green auroras. She flies under the midnight sun. The Belanca gets wrecked and patched so many times it's a jumbled mass of spare parts flying in formation, as Alaskans say. Better hope the termites keep holding hands, they say. Still, it flies well enough until a storm blows it away across a frozen lake and crashes it to bits against rocks on the other side. She gets another one with a bigger engine. Since she is herself again, she writes to Caleb, tells him where she is, encloses a separate letter for Jamie, asks for his address, since she can't imagine he's still in that flop house in Vancouver. Jamie has left Vancouver entirely, Caleb reports, and gone into the mountains to be, he thinks, an art hermit. The decision was sudden, and he wouldn't say why, but he seems fine. I guess all three of us were meant to live in splendid isolation. She considers flying to see Jamie, but finds she doesn't want to leave Alaska, is frightened by the thought of crossing back into her old life. So maybe she's not quite herself again. Not that she's foolish enough to think there is one fixed version of a person. In time, she heads south to Valdez, forms a loose partnership with a pilot who supplies the high-altitude load mines in the Wrangell and Chugach Mountains. He's worked out a method for landing on glaciers. If the light is flat, he makes a low pass and drops something dark, anything, a gunny sack or a branch, onto the ice to help with depth perception. He shows Marion how to look for the undulation in the surface snow that means buried crevasses, how to slip sideways on landing so the skis are at a right angle to the slope and the plane doesn't slide away over the edge. In Valdez, since she keeps skis on the plane all year for glacier landings, she takes off from mud flats when the tide is out. She learns to rock side to side in her seat as she throttles up to help pry the skis free from the ooze. To the mines, she delivers the usual meat and flour and tobacco, but also dynamite and carbide, steel and lumber and spools of cable, barrels of oil, all manner of machine parts. Once she has a pair of prostitutes as passengers, once a member of Roosevelt's cabinet. Once she flies an orphaned grizzly cub to Anchorage, bound for a private menagerie. People like to remind her that she is from outside. You can't become an Alaskan. It's just not possible. She is not one of them, but still, she feels she belongs. Denver, spring of 1937. Jamie edges around the bedroom door, and Uncle Wallace, sitting propped up with pillows, squints uncertainly. "It's Jamie," Jamie says. "I came to see you." Wallace's face cracks open with delight. "My boy," he says. "How wonderful." Jamie grasps Wallace's hands, sits on the edge of the bed, catching the sweet odor of morphine. "How are you?" "At death's door." Wallace pats Jamie's cheek, the patchy blonde scraggle that grows there. "But you're not a boy at all with this beard. It's been at least a year since I've seen you. Is that possible?" "I suppose it is," Jamie says, They have not seen each other in more than 5 years. 5 years since he'd put a frail, trembling drunk on the train to Denver.
And where is...
Marion's in Alaska. She's a pilot.
She's the reason I'm here, you know. Her and her husband. Is he in Alaska, too?
He's in prison. Wallace seems unsurprised.
Good, he says, but mildly, as though he'd been told the weather was fine.
Wallace's housekeeper, stout and matronly, pushes the door open with her rump, backs in with a tray of coffee and sliced cake.
Thought you might like a hot drink and something to eat, Jamie, after your journey.
This is my son, Jamie, Wallace tells her, patting Jamie's arm.
I've met Jamie, she replies. I let him in. He's your nephew.
To Jamie, she says, he gets confused, especially about names, things like that, details.
I'm not confused, Wallace says bitterly,
but when she holds a cup of water to his lips, he smiles and takes a docile sip. She touches his forehead, and Jamie wonders what they have been to each other.
Tell me something, Wallace says when she's gone. Anything. Dying is boring. Regale me with tales from outside this room.
Jamie tells Wallace about the mountain cabin where he lives, once abandoned, a half day's walk from the nearest settlement. He'd repaired the roof and floor, recocked the gaps between the logs. He keeps a garden and chickens for eggs. He fishes in a nearby river, has learned to can vegetables and smoke fish, to plan ahead for the winter.
You remember I wouldn't fish before?
He asks Wallace.
Yes, Wallace says vaguely, nodding. The worms, wasn't it? I felt sorry for the fish, Jamie says, not the worms. I still do, but I've made peace with it.
Wallace nods again.
You have to live the way you want, he says. That's what I did. No other life seemed honorable to them because theirs was such a wretched hardship. They thought anyone who lived another way was too big for their britches and must be immoral.
Now Jamie is confused.
Who thought that? Our parents, of course. You remember, you were the same way.
Wallace has him mixed up with Addison.
Was I?
Jamie says.
Of course you were. If you hadn't left, I might never have thought of leaving. But you had to go to sea.
Wallace pats his hand.
Tell me something else.
Though Jamie isn't sure whether Wallace is talking to him or Addison, he tells him, trying to make the story sound funny, about the two men who'd come to his apartment and nearly drowned him. How he'd assumed they'd been sent by Barclay McQueen when in fact they'd been emissaries of Mr. Ayukawa, whose daughter had run away, probably with some man.
We've all had mishaps, Wallace says. Then what?
In the mountains, he'd begun painting obsessively, even before he'd had a mattress or a functional stove. He'd stood in the ruined little shack and worked. I'd had an idea about incorporating the curvature of the earth into my paintings, and I've been building from there. I've been making landscapes that are sort of folded. Have you ever seen how the Japanese fold paper?
There is a sketch pad on Wallace's nightstand, and Jamie rips out a page, tears it carefully into a square, folds a crane.
A bird,
Wallace says, holding the delicate thing in his trembling fingertips.
Did the man pay you for the painting?
Jamie had laughed on the Ayukawa's doorstep, laughter that stung and buzzed in his sinuses like turpentine vapors. He'd bent over with his hands on his knees, wiping away tears.
She ran away? He'd said.
To Wallace, he says.
He paid me more than we'd agreed on. I think he felt guilty.
Good, Wallace says. Good. In 5 days, he is dead. There is a will, leaving the house in Missoula to Jamie and Marion. He wishes to be buried in Denver. Jamie delays writing to Marion, whom he feels obscurely estranged from, writes to Caleb instead. He does not intend for Caleb to go to Alaska to tell Marion the news, but that is what Caleb does. What's the closest you've ever come to dying? Marion asks Caleb. They are lying in her bed in her cabin outside Valdez. He has been with her for 3 nights. She doesn't know how long he will stay. She had sprung for a double bed to celebrate her return to her real name, and they have never had so much space to share. Sprawled on his back, he says, I don't know. I don't think you can know. Isn't there something in the past that chills you to think about? Not one thing in particular. Facetiously, it takes more than death to scare me, Marion. Do you remember after Trout died how I flew to Vancouver? She tells him about the skipping engine, the crevasse, the cold. That was when death had felt closest, she says. But maybe she'd actually been closest when she was a baby on the sinking Josefina. She would have died and never known anything about it. Never known what a ship was, or an ocean, or a fire. She wouldn't have known what death was. Caleb said he thought all living things knew about death, at least enough to struggle against it. Or maybe I came closest some other time, she said, and didn't even notice. The first night, after he'd told her Wallace was dead, after they'd walked along the shore, watching the sea lions and bald eagles, she'd drawn him into bed. She hadn't been with anyone since Barclay, and memories of him came as sharp intrusions of panic and claustrophobia. She hadn't told Caleb what Barclay had done, but he seemed to have an instinct. He held her gaze when he came, offering her his helplessness. The second night had been better, and the third, and on this, the fourth, she'd almost believed she'd returned to the time back before Barclay, when she and Caleb had made love with simple urgency. Almost. She can never go back. He is broader than she remembered. Solid, a man. A little impatiently, he says. It's too much to think about, everything that might have happened but didn't. But in the same brusque tone, he says to the ceiling, There was one time when I was a kid. Gilda had a man. Usually I ignored what she did, but that night I couldn't take the sound of them. I decided to go to your house, even though it was snowing hard. It didn't even occur to me to worry about finding my way, but the snow was piling up. I couldn't see the shape of the ground to get my bearings. I couldn't see anything, really. The wind was up. I'd been walking for much too long, but I didn't want to admit I was lost. Not that admitting it would have changed anything. I knew I shouldn't, but I sat down to rest. He stops. She remembers Barclay's story about the night they'd met, about collapsing drunk in the snow. Then what? Well, I didn't die. Go on, tell the rest. You can imagine. I got too cold. I remember trying to decide if I could bear to keep living with Gilda. In the end, I don't know if I really decided anything. But I stood up and walked a little way, and then I saw the lights of your house not far away at all. I went in through the kitchen and tried to pretend I wasn't as cold as I was, but Barrett wasn't fooled.
Marion props herself up. I remember that. I'd forgotten all about it. Is that what happened? I remember you coming in completely blue and Barrett whisking you away. I listened at the bathroom door and heard you crying in the tub.
He winces. My hands and feet were frozen. Thawing them was awful. Barrett kept asking why I'd been outside, and I kept telling her I'd heard wolves around the cabin and had gone out to hunt them. Usually, she didn't have any patience for my tall tales, but that time she played along. She asked if I'd gotten any. She sat beside the tub and listened to me chatter while I thawed. I was crying the whole time, it hurt so bad.
Good old Barrett.
He makes a small sound of agreement, says, but afterward, for some reason, what Gilda did didn't matter anymore. I felt, I don't know, fortified. Like suddenly I was aware I could choose my fate.
I think I understand.
She tells him, flatly, about the war she'd fought with Barclay over her womb, the siege she'd endured. I needed a shock to leave. It was the pregnancy that fortified me. He rolls over to kiss the inside of her elbow, and when he lifts his head, his face is strained with anger. I already hated him, but now I want to kill him. There are worse things. That's not the point. It's in the past. Not entirely. You're changed.
You're not.
They smile. She says, I can't make myself understand that I'll never see Wallace again.
Have you forgiven him?
I think so. Barclay would have found another way. Caleb makes a strange grimace. He sent me a letter for you. Everyone knows I'm your postmaster.
Wallace did?
She doesn't understand why he has waited so long.
No.
Barclay. Caleb gets out of bed, rummages in his bag, drops a sealed envelope in her lap. Marion, I don't know where you are, but I will live with not knowing. Not knowing is an atonement I can make, and one I know you would want from me. In case you doubt the weight of my sacrifice, I will tell you my dearest dream is to walk out of these gates a free man, find you, and beg forgiveness. Without your forgiveness, I believe I can never consider myself truly free, and so I won't be. I'm sure you think I want something more. That forgiveness, once gained, won't satisfy me, and I'll try to forge onward to take back your love, and that I will be as I was before. Too passionate, throwing myself against your walls until I am battered beyond recognition to either of us. I used to think that if only you would open to me and embrace what was between us, we would both be happier. I was so caught up, so overwhelmed by my own certainty, I couldn't see that you are someone for whom being fully open is the same as being destroyed. You kept telling me that the version of you that seduced me in the first place was incompatible with the version of you I wanted for a wife. You exert such a mighty pull on me, Marion. I was turned inside out by it. My guts were hung out for the birds to peck. I regret the things I did while writhing in that particular agony. I'm not blaming you, but I'm offering my suffering as a small token of explanation. I deserve to suffer more, I know. I can't say I'm glad there was no baby, but I do recognize that maybe some larger wisdom was at work there. I'll leave this now, Marion. I expect no reply, though I long for one. I won't assume your forgiveness, but I'll continue hoping to see you again one day, so I might ask for it in person. Barclay. P.S. Perhaps you've heard somehow, but Sadler and Kate have married. Are you surprised?
I was.
I wish them more happiness than we found.
Marion sits for a moment with the letter open in her lap. Her eye catches the word passionate again, and she leaps from bed to throw the papers into the stove. After Caleb leaves, Marion is lonely for the first time since coming to Alaska. The uninhabited ring of space she'd cultivated around herself begins to seem less like a protective barrier than scorched earth. At night, restless, she thinks of Caleb, sometimes of Barclay.
of how he'd been before he turned. A turn. That is how she thinks of what happened when he'd pried the diaphragm from her body. She touches herself, thinking of Barclay more often than Caleb, and afterward is ashamed, troubled. As an experiment, she goes to bed with a man, and then a few others. Ones she seems unlikely to run into again, or can reliably avoid if she wants. No pilots, no miners, nobody in Valdez. There is a boat builder in Seward, a newspaperman in Anchorage, a Canadian geologist just passing through. Alaska has a glut of men. From each encounter, she takes a small supply of images that she shovels like burial earth on top of her memories of Barclay. A stranger's face contorted and exposed by concentration. The grip of hands on her hips. Certain murmured words. She wondered what memories they take from her, what fragments they revisit in lonely times.